Yeah, that's since the start of my career there. Well, we have a couple of people here that could do this much better than I could do this, but I was drafted to do this. One of the advantages is, as an extension agronomist, the soil carbon is just some black stuff to me. And so I'm not going to get very technical with this. What I want it to be, though, and we've already heard this morning some results. By the way, those were from the Champagne marl pods. These are the Urbana marl pods that I'm talking about. There is a difference. This happens to be about 100 meters inside of Urbana. So we'll leave that as it may be. I think those earlier results were from the same plots, but I'm not sure. And what I want this to be really is more the story of the marl plots, and Bob Dunker told this pretty well yesterday, and I'm repeating some of what he said. And I did put in some things about organic carbon as it's been measured over the years. And you heard this morning with the first speaker some modeling efforts that were made. I don't really have very many comments on this. This shows the marl plots in there's basically a six-year cycle in the marl plots. That is, the north one, the farthest one that you can see there, is continuous corn every year. The center one is corn-soybean rotation. And the one nearest to us is the corn oat hay, as it's called. And that's a three-year rotation. So that's oats there, for those of you who don't recognize that, one of our major crops in Illinois. And we do have, and some of the earlier question was asked with the model about whether the oats contributes a lot more root material than we might think, and I'm pretty sure the answer is no. Oats is a crop that we all know and love, but it's not a very big yielder. And you know that we talk about bushels here, and it's got light bushels, and I don't think it does much else that's very miraculous either. But it's in the rotation, and so we have to talk about it. So this, I'll describe this, and the grandiose title here is Trends Over 100 Years. We do have soil organic carbon data from that period of time, and so we'll do that. And I left some of these in that Bob Dunker had provided. I thought it was a good perspective just to think, where do these plots come from and why? And these really were born out of the sort of revolution that I think started in Rothamsted and spread to North America eventually. This shows the founding of the university and the Hatch Act and the Homestead Act and the Morrill Act. But you can see there the Morrill plots actually started in 1876 and the Ag Experiment Station in 1888. We don't have very much record from those early years, but it did start in 1876 officially. And we'll talk about that. This is sort of an interesting shot. Davenport Hall up here on the top right is still here, still with us. Agriculture isn't there anymore. But this gives you a perspective of how things might have looked at that time. And in the early days, agricultural research was located on campus, which was mostly a field. Later, then, this sort of developed into these experiment fields around the state, just of historical interest, that we had lots of them. And they all had a similar layout there that was basically a soil fertility experiment. And you understand this was coming out of an era where low-yielding soils were just low-yielding soils. There was no good fix for it. And so the miracle that was P and K, and to some extent manure, was sort of born during that time, and that was really the basis for these. So this spread around and we used it, and this is one that is a particularly interesting one. Cyril Hopkins there standing, if you count those are two bushel bags of wheat, and we're gonna stick with it, you know, in a historical moment here, we'll stick with bushels mostly today, but I was too lazy to change them. But you can see here what a miracle that really wrought. If you count the bags on the right there, that's, I don't know, upwards towards 40 bushel, which would have been just an astonishing yield if people were used to the 6 bushel that you see there on the left. And the bread from stones, of course, refers to the phosphorus and rock phosphate that was used to provide nourishment to the crop. So this is an early shot, and if you have questions about these, Bob Dunker's in the audience, so you can ask him. But these were established by Professor Manly Miles with an assist from George Morrow, for whom they're named, to basically study the effect of crop rotations on yield. Corn was a major crop in Illinois at that time. We first reached 10 million acres of corn in the state of Illinois before the year 1900. So you can tell that it was the crop, and continuous corn was one of the cropping systems at the time. The soil there is a Flanagan silt loam, fairly level. It's a mollisol, of course, derived under prairie vegetation, mostly grasses, and you can see the description there. Very typical of an Illinois lust-derived soil. There is a difference in the depth to till there. It says 40 to 60 inches of lust. I don't know, Bob, we're probably a little bit on the lower end of that, I would guess, on average in the Morrow plots, somewhere around a meter of windborne materials on top of glacial till that's not particularly conducive. But these soils are clearly very productive. There is some, and I just put a note here, some subsurface or tile drainage has been installed. We don't really know where those are. Apparently some were cut in some recent construction, so we had a wet spot that developed. And that's really how we know that there must have been some there. This is also a little bit interesting. There were 10 of these plots originally. Each was 5 rods by 16 rods. I'm sure you all use that term a lot, which is a half an acre or 0.2 hectares. Plots 1 and 2, the observatory you saw in the opening shot, was built in the late 19th century, and those were terminated at that point. And 6 through 10 on the left-hand side. I suspect that probably the building of that building might have been taking place somewhere around that time or a little bit later, but they terminated those. So of the original plot, only 3, 4, and 5 remain. And if you see me refer to 3, 4, and 5, you'll know what that means. So I'm going to give you a series of these that Bob Dunker put together. The first idea in the experiment that ran from 1876 to 1904 was only to test the effect of crop rotation. What could changing the rotation, say from continuous corn or corn oats, clover, what would it do to yields? I would say that, you know, I wasn't quite around at the time, but probably corn, oats, clover was more common, I would guess. The idea that you'd produce continuous corn, certainly it was a possibility under our soils, but the idea here was simply to see how much difference in yield it made if you use different rotations. And you can see here the yields were mildly different. That top one is somewhere in the 2.5, 2.4 tons per hectare range. And they went up modestly from that, up maybe 10 or 12% if you rotated. So the yields were low and there wasn't a huge difference, but there was a little bit of difference. And the lessons from these, from that, and during that time period, as I said, yields were low and somewhat lower in continuous compared to rotated corn. And this one's speculative because I don't think we have the samples to go back to show this. At least I didn't have access to them. Soils were likely depleted in various nutrients by the production of crops without fertilizer over that period of time. The changes weren't fully documented, but ending soil organic carbon levels, which you'll see here in a minute, were on the order of corn oats hay was greater than corn oats was greater than continuous corn. This is the next phase then. For about 50 years, these held forth, and we'll talk about this period. It was a critical one in the long-term changes that we're talking about. All of the residues were removed during this period on all of it. So if you came hoping for a nice controlled experiment, this isn't it. The stubble, yeah, you can leave now if you'd like. The stubble and the root residues were returned to the soil, of course. By stubble, we think that, you know, it's a common practice at the time. They took a corn knife out, cut these plants off, brought them up, put them together, husked them, and took the stalks off and did something with them. We don't know what. But that's how they did that. So there was probably a stubble of, I don't know, 10 to 15 centimeters typically left on the soil, depending on how ambitious they were when they were cutting it. The oats, the small grain, those would have been cut, mowed, baled off. So it was a little more thorough operation, probably, to get the hay off. All of this would have been horse-drawn equipment at the time, of course. The average yields are given here with the, and this was during this period, the manure, lime, and phosphate, and the RP means rock phosphate, and the BP means bone phosphate. And that was apparently one of the hot items at the time, was determining what the best source of phosphorus was. So rock phosphate was more readily available, of course, but bone phosphate could be had. And you can see that there weren't huge differences. The bone phosphate appears to have been a little bit better, and we don't know, have any idea why that might have been. This is a almost 50-year average yields then. And continuous corn did not yield well without any fertilizer during that period. If you remember, that's less than it yielded before that period. And the corn oats yielded somewhat better, and the corn oats clover yielded considerably better. And we'll talk a little bit about why that might have been. These are the corn yields now, remember. And corn yields increased generally during this period of time, especially with the introduction of hybrids. The fertility additions certainly did good things for the yields, nearly doubled them with two of the rotations and raised them substantially in the third. And so it does bring up the question, aside from the soil organic carbon, what was really limiting yields here? And obviously one of the answers was nutrition. Nitrogen, probably phosphorus, and putting lime on was a good thing as well. This is just a photograph that Bob put in as an example of how these results used to be presented. A lot of photographic evidence given. This was from 1909, and you can see this one on the left is no rotation, corn every season, 30 years, it says, no soil treatments, 27 bushels per acre. And of course, going up to the two-crop rotation, and up to the three-crop rotation on the left. It does mildly make me curious why corn oats would really yield better than corn. But I suspect that corn following corn was, in some extent, just removing more nutrients. I didn't put oat yields in here, but I think, Bob, on a bushel basis, they were fairly similar to the corn yields, which would mean that without fertilizer, the oats yields in that rotation were probably coming in at the 30 to 35 bushel range. But remember, it's a light bushel, so that's only down in the probably 1.3 tons per hectare range. This shows the trend in yields over the time, and it's pretty dramatic. As in most farmers' fields during the 30s and 40s, with the use of hybrids and so on, yields went up considerably. Now, this is a slide that tries to lay this out a little bit. One of my points with this is that it's an experiment that has some limitations because of the design. Throughout the period organic carbon and nitrogen have been analyzed, the west half sections on the left there, those are called A and B after this period, contained less organic matter and nitrogen with some exceptions. And the other important point is we're not quite sure how they got there. Remember, we had cropping systems in place before this period. So as Bob says here, the east and west halves of the Mara plots probably had different management histories even before these plots were established. I don't think there's NRCS records going back to the middle of the 19th century, but so we don't really know. But, you know, it was very common to have small fields and pastures and haymaking and oats and corn and oats to feed horses and so on. So the inherent differences should always be considered when we're talking about the results from here. This is my attempt to graph some of these differences over time. These soils were periodically sampled. I've tried to do them to take out some of the noise in these samples, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. To do them like this is more of an aggregated thing. And this shows pretty clearly what happened. Basically, when manure, lime, and phosphorus were added, soil organic carbon levels maintained at their starting level. When they were not added, when no fertilizer were added, they all declined. And as you can see, they declined pretty much on a consistent basis. The slopes of those lines are very similar, regardless of the rotation. I also added in another box there, which was my attempt to bring in something about carbon removal, because we were removing it all. And in a general sense here, I think you can take 1% organic carbon in the top 15 centimeters is somewhere around 20 tons per hectare, give or take, of megagrams of carbon. And so we're at a 50 to 60 to 70 ton level here. And this was the total removed over the 50-year period. These are just estimates that I made, going back and taking the yields to try to get a guess, and the oats yields, the hay yields, and the corn yields as well. So I don't know if there's a magic formula for converting that, but you could actually look at this and say, it looks to me like you needed to add a certain amount to maintain, and the only ones up there that maintained the lowest input that was able to maintain these levels was the corn-corn manure lime phosphorus plots. They're that the lower of the sort of parallel lines you see there. The lessons from that period were manure lime and phosphorus source additions increased crop yields but did not completely replace rotations. Rotations increased yields, and we have to remember here that the 1 year of clover, the clovers would be established routinely then by frost seeding into the small grain or seeding at the same time as oats. And the clovers would grow that summer, sometimes well, sometimes not well, and then they would be there the entire next year. So there was a substantial amount of nitrogen addition from that, and nitrogen is clearly important in this whole thing we're talking about here. Rotations increased yields but did not completely replace the added nutrients, and soil organic carbon dropped over this period modestly in the manure lime phosphorus plots, I say 0.14 points, percentage points. If we multiply that times our 20 tons, that's only about 2 or 3 tons total carbon drop, and about 0.65 or about 4 to 5 times more in the untreated checks. And a curious thing when you think about it, but I think the untreated checks were simply so deficient in the nutrients they needed to grow that these things just continued to decline. Their inputs of carbon, root carbon for example, declined over that period certainly. The differences in change in soil organic carbon among rotations was relatively small. Just a little bit of history here. Here's how these plots were put out before my time. Actually, during my time, there was, I think, a little hand planting, Bob, and some hand harvesting. It's a little bit different now, I hear. This is the next phase of this then, and this is one when chemical fertilizers were added into the mix. Otherwise, they look pretty similar, and this is only about a 12-year, 13-year period here. and you can see what the yields did during that period. So adding, I mentioned that nutrients were clearly limiting, and I think you see here adding lime, nitrogen at 200 pounds per acre, or about 225 kilograms per hectare, and then the other treatments. You can see what that did to the yields. The lowest one, the manure lime phosphate, at least with a couple of the rotations, it still maintained the yields just as well. Now, I believe the intent was with the manure to put on an equivalent amount of nitrogen during that period. Bob, was that your understanding of it?
Yes.
So that's, you know, you wouldn't expect those two to really differ. And I'm not sure why the rock phosphate, bone phosphate would have been different at that time. This is changes in soil organic carbon. Remember, they started different levels here. We saw that at the end of the last one. And basically, I guess I would conclude that they pretty much maintained during that short period. Now, we could get into an argument about, well, that looks like a drop or that looks like an increase, and I'm not going to get into that argument. Well, but that's what we saw. What I've done in this and some subsequent graphs, to get away from the year-to-year interannual variation in these, I've averaged years that are close together if I had them. In other words, if we tested in 59, 60, and 61, I averaged those. So, from 55 to 67, soil organic carbon levels, this is the real change here was adding the chemical fertilizer. Soil organic carbon levels started lower in continuous corn and lower in untreated checks of the rotations than in the manure lime phosphorus plots. We saw that previously. Changes during the period were very small and were not consistently affected by rotation soil treatment or by the starting soil organic carbon levels. This means, of course, that ending levels of soil organic carbon were different. This is just a shot showing that manure used to be put on in a very irritating and labor-intensive method, and we've switched now. I did add a note there that I think was brought up before, that you said the same things happened at Missouri, where the carbon input has changed as we've changed manure type. It's decreased, actually. So this is into the last stretch of time now. These are the average corn yields over these more recent years, not coming up to the present years, where the yields have actually been higher in recent years than they were previous to that. But now we have the rotation, corn oats rotation changed to the corn soybean rotation. And there's another one in there, the manure lime phosphate are added together now, or averaged together, and we converted one of them to the high nitrogen P and K, what Bob called the, what, pull out all the stops, kitchen sink treatment. I think it was done in the spirit of the maximum yield idea back in the late 60s, early 70s. And for 1967 to 1998, I believe, it maintained the high LHNPK there is 300 pounds of nitrogen and more P and K. You can see here it didn't exactly do wonders for yields. In fact, it didn't increase them at all. And with the corn oats clover, it actually looks like it decreased the yields. But that was a substantial change that was made. And you can see here what the yield levels obviously are much higher. I summarized those averages over that period, and we stop in 03 because that was the last time before 2009 that we had corn in all of the plots. So we kind of do that on that basis. But you can see here that what the difference between corn and soybean yields were, and you can see that after you put some amendments on, soybean yields pretty much stayed the same, and at about 3.7, 3.8 tons per hectare, and adding the extra nitrogen, you can see, did not increase the corn yields at all. The manure lime phosphate, that was manure lime phosphate before 1955. Remember, we started to add chemical fertilizer at that point. This shows you the variation, the interannual variation that we get in some of the sampling that's been done there, and what a challenge it is to choose the points to best represent what you want to say. And this is why these are in individual plots, and that's why I averaged them the way I did. So these are three-year average data centered on 68, 81, and 92, showing more recent changes. And again, there look like to be some squiggles there. Some of them look like they're fairly substantial, at least in the early half of that period. In the last half of that period, in the last 25 years, there do not seem to have been any appreciable changes. I did it a little bit differently here, just looking at the change from 80 to 82 versus 2007-2008 when these were last sampled. And this is the change in soil organic carbon for the different rotations and treatments during that period of time. Now, you can imagine some of those are different, but it does take imagination. There's no way to tell that these are whether these are significant or not, because it's not replicated. But being as small as they are, I would be fairly surprised. The interesting, the continuous corn with the high nitrogen, the third one from the left there, is the one that's, you know, purported to bring down carbon content using excess nitrogen. And maybe it did, but it surely doesn't show up there. So beginning soil organic carbon levels, and it sounds like a broken record, but they were different. There have been no substantial or consistent changes in soil organic carbon level in any of the rotations or treatments over the past 40 years. Soil organic carbon levels remain different today, consistent with the differences that we saw in 1955. And this is just, I'm going to just finish out with a little bit of detail on this. I know my time is up. This is organic relationship between organic carbon and yields. There is some correlation there. It's not clear that this is cause and effect. This might be largely related to location in the plots. And Bob has done some testing recently. As I said, there's no replication, and we don't know the causes for some of the differences that appear there now. Treatments were not randomly assigned within the rotations. So as you can see here, the manure lime phosphorus is in each quadrant of those main plots, each place, each time. No exercise of random number generation was ever employed in laying these plots out. There's another one that many people don't realize or don't know about, and that is that we have confounded plant populations with the treatments. There was reason to do this back when the experiment started, and, you know, 8,000 was probably a reasonable population. It's one reason yields were low for the first 80 years of this trial, or 70 years, and those remain in place today. And Bob took some of the data and showed that this is clearly in effect. The dilemma is that I said current high populations are not very high, and uniform high populations would probably mean little or no yield in the nutrient limited untreated check plots. So you're caught. What do you do? Pretty sure if we put those untreated check plots, which are yielding poorly today, 3 tons per hectare or so, under a high population, they wouldn't yield anything. And Bob Dunker has also gone out and measured some soil conductivity. These are recently, these are interesting numbers. They show that there are differences that seem to be aligned with plots. There's no good way to know which caused which. These may well have been inherent from the beginning of the experiment. The design of the location of them seems to indicate they may well have been inherent. So this is soil conductivity. There's some organic carbon and conductivity correlations. This is some penetrometer data. This is showing soil strength in a 27 to 36 inch zone. And these don't seem to line up with treatment nearly to the extent as you would expect they would not. But they are having an effect on yield. So these are just a bunch of cautionary things, and the data analysis issues remain. They are confounded, so separation of many treatment effects is impossible, and this does allow selective use of data, which I'm sure nobody really wants to do, but it's kind of hard to avoid. A systems approach is best to look at trends over time, but the experimental design limitations simply have to be detailed. And to finish up, in some ways the Morrow plots are better history than science, is the way I put it. At the same time, they represent the longest running set of crop production systems in the U.S. and for these exact systems in the world. With appropriate caution, soil organic carbon data can help us understand these trends over time. Cause and effect is going to remain fairly elusive. Thank you.
Well, given what you just said in the paper that's just out by Mulvaney et al., how do you respond to that, I guess? A different interpretation, I guess.
Yeah, it's a different interpretation. I honestly don't know. That one stemmed from the difference in carbon that he reported earlier with the high nitrogen treatment particularly. Remember, those are in three plots out there, each in its separate rotation. And I remain a little puzzled about how you can statistically derive a difference. In fact, the difference I showed in organic carbon between the in the last from 80 to recently, and it was actually positive with that treatment. So it would take some creativity.
Are your results in Malvani's from the same samples?
No, I think his were from 2005 set of samples that he took. Is that right, Bob?
Yes.
The most recent samples are not the ones that he used. He used a set in 2005. That could explain part of it, but it doesn't get away from the fact there's enough interannual variation that you really don't know. And you can't solve that.
All right, we'll be back at 1 o'clock and we'll have an opportunity at the end of the session to pick up some other questions.
Yeah, I'm